Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. We have a tendency to take emotions for granted, but have you ever stopped to think where emotions originate? If you think the brain, then you're getting close. But what about areas of the brain and different kinds of emotion originating from different areas? How well do emotions affect behavior? Why do humans have emotions? Are they learned or are they inherited? Well, we discuss these questions and perhaps learn even more about the brain, emotion, and social behavior when we discuss these issues with today's guest, Anchorage neuropsychologist Dr. Deborah Gideon. If you've got questions or comments during the next hour, if you live in Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8433. That's 550-8433 for local callers. A toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Gideon, it's a pleasure to have you back. I had forgotten that you had been here back in the 90s, probably not too long after we started doing this on some brain trauma issues,
right,
and traumatic
right.
brain injuries. Mm-hmm. So you're a neuropsychologist, and I'm going to jump to the conclusion. A lot of listeners may not know exactly what a neuropsychologist is and what they do. So tell us a little bit about training and what you do every day and what we can learn from a neuropsychologist.
All right. Well, thanks for having me here. I'm really happy to be able to talk about this topic, too. Neuropsychology is the study of the relationship between brain function and emotion and thinking. Mostly we think about the brain in terms of thinking abilities like memory and attention and so on, but also emotion and behavior. And the understanding of neuropsychology is developed through scientific studies and through our clinical experiences over time, although it's a relatively new field. The training that's involved, you asked about that, it requires the doctorate in psychology with specialty training in neuropsychology, a lot of emphasis on the neurosciences, of course, more of the medical side of behavior, and requires pre- and postdoctoral training in study of the brain, as well as clinical psychology, understanding human behavior, of course, in general, and abnormalities that affect people, so the clinical psychology part of that, too. Yes, I guess that's pretty much it sums it up.
And your day-to-day work right now is seeing people with problems with emotions or trauma to the head and the results of that?
Mm-hmm. Actually, a variety of different kinds of problems, problems with thinking and emotion. Often people know that there's been some event that's happened. Let's say they've had a brain injury or a stroke. Or perhaps they know that they had been diagnosed with attention deficit as a child or some kind of learning problems, or maybe they have seizure disorders, or it may be that there are some behaviors that are kind of confusing to their providers, to them, to their families. They don't really understand what is happening and what to do about it. And often people in those situations will come to a neuropsychologist and ask what we can do to help. And with that, we will usually engage them in a neuropsychological evaluation.
Okay. What kinds of things you're talking about that they may have noticed with their providers? Memory issues, something that kind of comes to my mind, their ability to may focus and attention, mm-hmm. emotional issues, maybe mm-hmm. depression even?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Those are some of the more common ones, but actually other things that happen to people, like suddenly someone might have difficulty controlling his or her emotions, maybe getting irritable more easily or angry more easily, or maybe doing some things that just don't make a whole lot of sense in terms of interpersonal relationships. And depression certainly is a big one. Anxieties and fears can be another part. But it may be that they're having unusual thoughts and don't know what to make of those. Or it may be that a provider has been working with somebody going on one path, thinking that this approach may be effective, and is getting frustrated with the lack of maybe progress or success, and chooses to come to the neuropsychologist to get more information about what might be happening with their brain and what could be done to help them more effectively.
And you have a battery of tests that are validated that help you distinguish how that person is doing relative to normal individuals.
Absolutely, absolutely. Maybe I should say a little bit about what a neuropsychological evaluation
Sure.
entails. So it's really a pretty involved process. So the first part of it really involves getting that background history information about an individual. We want to make sure that when we give these instruments, these tests of a variety of different abilities, that those that we can look at those in the context of that individual's background, so medical and developmental and social and academic and employment background. So we get we first see the person for an interview, get a lot of background information, and then we administer these tests that have been developed through a lot of scientific studies with a lot of normative data. So they've been given to a lot of people without brain disorders to see how the average person performs. They're administered in a very standard manner. You say the same thing every time when you give the test to a person. You do the same thing so that you know that the behavior that you're seeing is actually a consequence of their particular kind of information processing rather than something different that you might be doing in handling the test materials. So it's a very standardized procedure. When you get the results, you compare the person's scores to the normative data to see if they are statistically significantly different from the average. And then you look at this pattern of scores from all of these different tests of thinking abilities and determine if that person has a disorder of their thinking or of their brain function, I should say, and how it relates to their thinking and their emotional and social behavior. So these different tests cover a wide variety of areas. And the reason for doing that is because we know that different parts of the brain are in different systems. It's really a complex interactive neural network, but different parts of the brain and systems are responsible for different kinds of thinking abilities and relationships among those. And by studying those abilities, we can tell a lot about what the brain is doing. So we can do a lot with aiding diagnosis, clarifying diagnosis, but we also can tell a lot about what the individual is doing in terms of their day-to-day functioning. And with that information, then we sit down with the individual afterward and explain the results and discuss what our recommendations are and fit those into what the person's looking for, what they hope to have, what they hope to accomplish, help them to find the kinds of resources or the kinds of interventions that they need, help them to understand what is possible, what may be less advantageous to them or not possible. A report is written to put all that together, a written report. So it's a pretty involved process.
Do you pick different instruments based on the history that you've got, or is it pretty much a standard group of tests that everyone is given? What's the algorithm? What are you doing? If certain things are found on a screening test, you move in a different direction, for example, or how's that done?
Yes, absolutely. There tend to be a certain core of instruments that are given, a certain core that's given, so that you're looking at, for example, general intellectual functioning in a variety of different domains that involves a variety of different domains. That's a common component. But it may be that you know an individual or suspect an individual has a deficit or dysfunction in a particular area. You may focus some of your tests or add instruments that might look more closely at that area. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there is a personalizing. There's a sort of a core, but then you add those additional instruments to personalize that evaluation.
So we've kind of agreed that the topic today is the brain, emotions, and social behavior. I guess I'm wondering, can you do neuropsychological testings looking at emotions in particular?
That's a good, really good question. It's been difficult to study emotion for a long time, and it's part of the reason why emotions and the brain have not been understood as well until more recently, and more efforts have been directed. There are a number of reasons why emotion has not been studied in the brain, probably, but one of them is that it's a little more difficult. But with neuropsychological evaluation, with knowledge of brain function, role in emotion, and the forms of emotional expression, things that manifest in, for example, processing emotional facial information, also behavior and different parts of the brain that are responsible for emotions. We know that those parts of the brain aren't working normally, and we see that that person has an emotional symptom. Let's say it's depression, and the left frontal frontal lobe functions are not what they should be. That's a kind of a pretty consistent relationship. Mm-hmm. So we know that, hey, there's something going on with this person's brain that's related to this depression, and it's causing these left frontal lobe functions. So you there is a relationship there. We do have tests of emotional experience, response to stress, what we can call personality, ways of behaving and thinking and relating to people. And those are objective measures, very well developed. Use those measures to relate those then to the other test data and put those together with our knowledge of the brain and emotion.
So what is emotion then? How do you define that? That seems to me one it'd be hard to get your a grip on.
That's a very complex.
We recognize emotion when we see it, but how do we define it? I mean, it's one of those kind of words.
Absolutely, and like I said, that's why emotion has been a little bit elusive to us in the scientific realm of studying it. But I think we can think of emotion, of course, first of all, as a physiologic response. So we all know what it means to have heart pounding or stomach fluttering or muscles tightening, that sort of thing. But also, there's a component of that sort of awareness of subjective experience of it, like, I'm feeling happy right now, or I'm feeling a lot of sadness, or that there's a recognition of that. And then there is a behavioral component to it, which can take a number of different manifestations. One of them could be outward behavior. So you respond sort of impulsively by saying or doing something, or maybe not impulsively, but you respond to that emotion outwardly. Or it may be that you restrict your behavior. Introverts tend to be more restrictive in their response to emotion. Or it may be that you're thinking. A lot of people think of behavior or think of thinking, cognition, as behavior. And so that's a type of behavioral response to emotion. In fact, that is one of the ways that a lot of unhealthy emotions are perpetuated is through our thinking. And we know that different structures in the brain are responsible for thinking and memory. And actually, some of those are involved in some of the psychotherapeutic processes. Some of the recent studies have shown.
Yeah, I want to hopefully have time to get into that. Let's stay on emotion for a second. I'm trying to understand this pretty well. And where does emotion come from? Is it something that we are born with? Is it something that is affected by experience? All of the above? What do we know?
Well, that too is a complex question. We know that our bodies and our brains produce a lot of emotional response that are they're activated. Parts of our brain are activated during the experience of what we call emotion, and we know that the brain itself is responsible for that, the production of that emotional experience. However, there also is a very important component of our learned or our learned experience or our environmental, the environmental impact on our emotion. Actually, there historically there's been a dispute as to whether or not it's all internal, it's all organic, as it used to be called, and all, or all functional, sort of learned, and a part of what mm-hmm. was the environment. And some people, like B.F. Skinner, would say, oh, there's nothing inside. It's all, everything you do is a function of the environment and your response to the environment. Mm-hmm. And others, like Freud, would say, oh, no, it's all internal, emotional right. kind of experience. What we know now is that there's this really complex interrelationship between the two,
right.
between the environment and our bodies. And in fact, you know, there's such a complex interrelationship. We're far from fully understanding that, but we're learning more and more how just simple experiences of communicating or repeating certain behaviors or just talking can change brain structure. So I think we're learning that it's not such an easy differentiation to make.
Yeah.
So you can't blame
right.
it all on somebody's upbringing,
sure.
for example.
Right.
Or you can't say, oh, well, it's just their biology is responsible.
Right.
But the two have this really complex interrelationship, and so you have to look at both.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's the nature-nurture idea in all of biology is kind of falling by the wayside in that it's an interaction between the two. As we specifically, as we get to understand more and more about genetics and how even the environment can affect genetics.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets very, very complex. But it's always struck me as interesting as a pediatrician that you can look at a baby in the newborn nursery the first day alive and they are different. So there's definitely differences. So it tells you right away, it's very hard to understand how the environment has made all these babies different within the first several seconds of life. You know, some are easygoing, some are intense, some are persistent, some are not. Four daughters on my side, same mom, same dad, same everything, and they're different right from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
And so the concept of temperament is what I use to help describe that and help people understand that there are differences from the get-go, which suggests there's some genetic component at least. Doesn't mean there's not environmental component.
Mm-hmm.
And I just happen to believe, yeah, I think you can affect that genetic component by the environment, and the evidence is increasingly in that situation. So that's kind of what I hear you saying.
Oh, it is. I am saying that. It's really interesting. At the same time, though, you can think back to some of the identical twin studies where
yeah. mm-hmm.
the twins mm-hmm. raised apart, and you observe them, and they demonstrate remarkably similar behaviors in a lot of ways, too. But at the same time, we do know that environmental experiences, learning, and so on can really affect how our genetic makeup actually is manifested or not.
Let me remind listeners very, very quickly, my guest today is Dr. Deborah Gideon. She's an Anchorage neuropsychologist, and we're talking about the brain, brain structure, and what we know about brain structure and function and how it relates to emotion and social behavior. If you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. You can email us during the next now 45 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. That's LINEONE, line1@alaskapublic.org. And if you're listening from out of town or out of state or even across the country, you can call us toll free at 1-888-353-5752. This is next question is always one of the most difficult ones, but I think it's important, and that's to try to help listeners on the radio understand what we're talking about a little better. Can you easily describe brain, what the brain looks like, where all these different circuits are, what we know about the purpose of each of these circuits, and later I'll ask you how we know that stuff.
Okay, all right.
So that's a first question is hard enough.
Okay. Well, it's a little hard to draw a picture of the brain on the radio, but I know, you know, everyone has a general sense of what it looks like and probably knows a bit about the different areas. But when we're talking about emotion, we're talking about the entire brain, but the more primitive, raw emotional experiences, you could describe it that way, really emanate from the structures deep in the center of the brain, which are known collectively as the limbic system. And we know a lot about now the structures such as the amygdala and the hippocampus, prefrontal cortex, and their role in emotion. And those are those structures deep within the center of the brain. But those structures, of course, have these very extensive, very rich connections throughout the brain. It's not that those work in isolation, and those work, of course, in connection with all these other higher cortical regions that then process that information in different ways and make sense, integrate what comes in from the environment with those deep emotional experiences to make sense of them and to respond in a way that usually is adaptive.
So the limbic system is one of the older parts of
Absolutely.
The brain evolutionarily.
Uh-huh. It
so
is.
So we have this fear or flight kind of thing that comes back from amoeba.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they don't. So there, we can think of this idea of the brain in evolutionary terms as well to help us understand what's going on.
We can. We can think of man as being, of course, the most developed, with maybe exception of a couple of species. But actually, yes, with our frontal lobes especially, the very well-developed frontal lobes, we have been able to manipulate our environment a lot more than other animals and to make sense of it in different ways and to produce things that we don't see elsewhere. So,
but one of the ways we know this, just to carry this evolutionary idea, is we can study less well neurologically developed, I'm trying to choose my words carefully, animals such as mice or even simpler organisms and learn a lot about our own brain.
Absolutely.
Because they function very, very similarly.
Mm-hmm.
Because we evolved from them.
Yes. It was quite enlightening to me in my graduate studies to see the comparative psychology studies of animal behavior.
Uh-huh.
And to see that correspondence and how we were learning about emotion from animal brains,
right.
About human emotion from animal brains. I thought that was sort of enlightening.
Right. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
We learned all of biology from mice in particular. To a large degree.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we have a caller. I want to take the call, and then it's already time to kind of take a break here before we get into things much deeper. But let me ask Bob what his question is. Bob, what can we do for you?
Well, I'm curious about EMDR. I've been through some EMDR myself, and I never understood the effect. Is it targeting the emotions or the intellect when you're actually going through the deep movement desensitization training?
All right.
Well, that's a very good question, Bob. EMDR has become a really popular treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. It involves eye movements and repetitive eye movements, right to left, back and forth, right to left, repetitively, and the re-experiencing of traumatic experiences. And the research has been limited to date on what it actually is doing. There is some suggestion that there is some kind of synchrony between the two, between the sides of the brain that somehow activates critical portions of the limbic system, but it's still really unclear what is happening. And so the question still remains, what is the scientific basis for it? A lot of people seem to find great success with it, but the actual neuroscientific basis for it is not entirely clear at this point. People are doing some studies, but it's hard to really answer your question because I don't think it has been answered yet anywhere.
Okay. What's been your experience?
It worked for me, I know that.
Yeah. And a lot of people have very good experiences with it. So it doesn't mean it's not effective by any means. It's just that we don't know why, really, at this point.
Mm-hmm. The reason I asked, there's some very powerful emotions that came through when I was doing it. And so that's why I thought it was germane to today's topic.
Uh-huh. Oh, it is, absolutely. Post-traumatic stress is something, actually trauma, is really very, very important to how, what we learn and how we learn over our lives, especially in our early years. And those experiences influence how we behave in many situations, often when we don't realize that we're, why we're doing it or what we're doing. So yes, powerful emotions and emotional experiences are involved, and those do come forth in therapies that address post-traumatic stress. That's part of the process. And it's good to hear that you've had a very healing experience with that, and that's terrific.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for your call, Bob. All right, so let me, right now we're going to have to take our mid-break, and I want to remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break, and we'll continue with our discussion on the brain, emotions, and social behavior with neuropsychologist Dr. Deborah Gideon. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection, originating from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage neuropsychologist Dr. Deborah Gideon, and we've been talking about the brain, emotions, and social behavior. We've kind of just generally talked about what neuropsychologists do. We've introduced the idea of what emotions may be, where they may come from, and how they can affect behavior. And we're going to continue this discussion in a little bit more depth. You can email questions that come to you during the next 30 minutes or so to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. But please remember, if you're listening between 9 and 10 p.m. on Monday evenings, you're listening to a rebroadcast, and we will not be able to help you. You can always go to our archives at alaskapublic.org and listen to the program again, or refer someone to that our archives to listen to this this program. Dr. Gideon, another way that we have learned to understand about brain function is studying the results of injuries to brains. And there's a long history of this, but I want to try to focus on some of the more recent, very important information that we're learning from just traumatic brain injuries. Simple things like concussions, car accidents, football players. That's in the news. We hear a lot about it. What are we learning about the brain and emotions? And it's also telling us that we can look at emotions and behaviors and really realize that the brain is not working in certain ways as mm-hmm. well. Maybe we don't always think of it that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's has been really informative. Unfortunately, when you see the effects of these injuries, but we've learned so much about brain function with regard to all sorts of abilities. I think one of the interesting things that a lot of people have heard about is back in the 1800s, a fellow named Phineas Gage was a railroad worker who had a tamping rod, a steel rod. In an explosion, the steel rod was thrust through the left frontal lobe of his brain. It went straight through his head and completely out on the other side. And he lived. But what was really astonishing to everyone, and this was back in the 1800s, 1848, was how dramatically Phineas changed. And it wasn't just that, you know, he was responding to the trauma of the event or something like that. Phineas had been a mild-mannered, very balanced, very entrepreneurial, active, motivated, hard-working man, very nice man, who suddenly became this very different person who couldn't control his behavior. He would make very socially inappropriate jokes to people. He would lose control of his emotions and act in ways that he never did. He didn't respond in the same way in his job. He couldn't perform the duties of his job anymore. He was not able to carry out his activities in a planful way. And so that was sort of an eye-opener. But unfortunately, it took a long time for us to realize that, sure enough, the brain is related to emotion and personality. And yes, there have been other studies like the effects of strokes that have been enlightening to us. But the effects of brain injury have really told us a lot. Now, in the 50s, we had the advent of the automobile. And unfortunately, we started having a lot more, of course, brain injuries. And we did learn a lot about brain injury from the wars. And World War II, for example, neuropsychology really started to take off because people were studying the effects of gunshot wounds to the head, for example. But those are different than the effects of an injury to the brain from an automobile crash. What happens in those situations is that you're going along 40, 50, 60 or more miles per hour, and suddenly you stop. Whether your head actually impacts the windshield or part of the car or not, your brain suddenly stops in your skull. And that acceleration, deceleration injury, we call it. So you're accelerating a certain speed and suddenly you stop. When your brain slams against the bony prominences of your skull, it twists, it turns, the microscopic neurons, the fibers of the neurons twist and tear and shear, and then you have these effects that we now call in football injuries, interestingly enough, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. So, of course, brain injuries from car accidents can vary in severity depending on the severity of the accident, but the effects can be broad, varied, depend on the physics of the situation, the area of the impact, if there is one, position of the vehicle, and so on, all of these things. How many injuries the person's had before can affect the person's recovery. And again, that's one of the things that we've seen in football injuries as well. But so what we learned was that in these brain injuries, when you're moving forward at a rapid rate of speed and you stop, what hits first is the frontal lobes and the anterior part of the temporal lobes. Now, the frontal lobes, of course, are in the very front portion of the brain. The temporal lobes are those areas right sort of above your ears. And that frontal part there, just behind the frontal lobes, the frontal part of the temporal lobes, those areas are really important for a number of functions. One of the frontal lobes predominantly are responsible for self-regulation, self-control, the ability to sort through information in your environment and make decisions, to solve problems, to screen out unnecessary or irrelevant stimuli, to understand yourself in relationship to other people even, to control your emotions, to inhibit your emotions, to plan your behaviors, all sorts of things. I like to describe the frontal lobes as sort of the CEO of a company. If you've got a company that has all these departments, and the departments by themselves may do really well, but if it doesn't have a CEO that works well, then the company as a whole isn't going to work well together. So the same is true for the frontal lobe. The frontal lobe is sort of the CEO of the brain. And those parts of the brain are really important, too, for regulation of emotion, for the ability to express one's emotion in a regulated way or at all. For moods, we know that, for example, that the left frontal lobe is really important to positive emotion or to depression. If you have injury or damage to the left frontal lobe, the chances are good you are going to have the experience of depression. We know, we've learned that the two sides of the brain, for example, have different emotional valences, that the right hemisphere tends to be more negative, the left hemisphere tends to be more positive. The two hemispheres work in tandem. They inhibit one another. But if you have damage to one hemisphere, then the other hemisphere sort of takes off. It's not under the control of the opposite hemisphere. So in the case of depression, the left frontal lobe is damaged, the more negative right hemisphere sort of takes off, and there you have this depressive mood state. The opposite can actually happen with the right hemisphere. You get damage to the right hemisphere and the right frontal lobe. What you'll end up with is someone who might be euphoric, indifferent, even sort of excitable, happy-go-lucky, not a care in the world. So it's really quite astonishing to see the differences sometimes in what can happen with different kinds of injuries in different places. But we've learned a lot, unfortunately, from motor vehicle accidents. What I've seen a lot, too, is that people change dramatically like Phineas Gage did. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, couples will come in and say, my husband or my wife no longer is the same person. I don't know this person I'm married to. Mm-hmm. It's really hard on families. And not to mention the effects on the person, although sometimes the person isn't even aware that self-awareness is part of frontal lobe function. And so self-awareness may have left the person. They're not really aware of what they're doing, and they're maybe not aware of how they're affecting other people. Mm-hmm. And it's not because they don't, mm-hmm. It's their personality. They don't care. They're just that kind of person. They're absolutely not probably that kind of person. They've just changed dramatically because of the way their brains are not working now.
And particularly when it's this CEO of the brain that's affected. Mm-hmm. And just to make it clear, it doesn't have to be head trauma. It could be post-stroke. It could be,
right.
I'm guessing, even after post-traumatic stress.
To some extent, yeah. Post-traumatic stress is a little bit different with regard to how it affects the brain, but the two are, there is okay. a relationship, yes.
All right. Uh-huh. All right. So we've gotten to, because of studying effects to the brain and doing the neuropsychological testing, we've gotten very good at telling from the symptoms that a person might have where a problem in the brain may be, is what I'm hearing you say.
Right, right.
Can we now, have we gotten to the point where we can see structural or functional correlates with imaging studies? Have we gotten to that point as well?
Yes, we have. And the advent of PET neuroimaging and functional MRI have really enabled us to see what the brain is doing while someone is performing a task or going through some experience. And that's been really helpful because we're not just looking at the structure of the brain, but we're looking at the brain as it's working. And we see what parts of the brain tend to be activated or not. And yes, we have had a lot of good verification of what we have observed, and we've learned more about what structures of the brain are really responsible. For example, in the limbic system, the amygdala, this almond-shaped structure, sort of you could envision it sort of somewhere above your ears. You go halfway through each hemisphere. You're going to find it about midway there. It's been found to be really important for emotional learning, for experience of fear, some positive emotions too. And so what we've learned is, for example, in some people, like people with autism spectrum disorder, they sometimes have a very overactive amygdala, so they have that fear response when they look at people. And we've learned that in these individuals with autism spectrum who have these communication, social communication problems, an area of the brain called the fusiform gyrus, which is in the underside of the brain, it goes from the back of the brain up to that temporal lobe, which is kind of above your ears there on the underside of the brain. That's a really important structure for facial processing. We've learned that that part of the brain in people with autism spectrum disorder is not as active. So they're not making sense of the social information. That's what we observe. That's what we're seeing then when this part of the brain is not working normally when in these individuals. And yet what's happening is when they actually look at people, look at faces, their amygdala gets more activated. So they have a fear response when they look at faces. So they're not processing facial information like most people do and making sense of emotion in faces. But they're also having this fear response when they look at faces, so they look away. Interestingly, studies of psychopaths who are individuals, as we know, who have seem to have very little emotional response, not to care about the feelings of other people, can do things, commit crimes, horrific acts without seeming to have much emotional concern or the normal kind of fear response that we would have. In fact, what has been found in research is that psychopaths' amygdalae are less responsive and underactive. So they don't make those fear-based connections and don't learn from fear and don't learn to be afraid in situations that most of us might. So we have learned a lot more about the structures of the brain in regard to different emotional experiences.
I don't want to stay on this too long because we do have an email and another telephone call I want to try to get to. But when you mention the problem with autism, it's important to me because I see kids with the question of whether they're on the autism spectrum and making that diagnosis early. And everyone's certainly trying to understand that disorder better. But it also correlates to some things I've read about people that there are people that are sometimes not recognized who have face blindness. They cannot recognize faces. They look at somebody's face and you say, oh yeah, that's da 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 da. They look at that and they can't tell you who that face is. Mm-hmm. And so we're learning some very specific, maybe not so common, sometimes maybe more common than we would have thought, kind of problems. Does the same area of the brain that is associated with face blindness associated with the problem that autistic kids have with recognizing faces is where I'm trying to go to?
Absolutely. What I was just talking about, this fusiform gyrus, is really critical to that facial emotion, facial recognition. Uh-huh. There are other parts of the cortex that have been found to be involved in nonverbal communication. One part of nonverbal communication is recognizing emotion in faces, but and being able to communicate your emotion through your facial expression. Mm-hmm. The expression of emotion tends to be more anterior in the brain, which is where motor structures are, and the frontal lobe. So you your expression of emotion in your voice and your facial expression tends to come more from the frontal lobe, especially the right frontal lobe. The right posterior area of the brain is more responsible for comprehending or understanding emotion in faces and in vocal intonation and body language. And I have actually seen people who, for example, have an impairment in that facial recognition. It's actually the formal term is prosopagnosia. That are unable to recognize a face. Let's say it's somebody that the person has been working with for years, and the coworker changes her hairstyle, and the person comes in and thinks there's a new person working in that job until she speaks. So sometimes they'll be able to recognize the emotion or recognize the tone of voice, but not the face
right.
itself. And a lot of people have this disorder in varying degrees. It's, again, not an all or none thing, but it affects people's ability to interact in a socially meaningful way and disrupts people's behavior often without them understanding what's happening or other people understanding what's happening.
As I grew up with that, they don't recognize everybody doesn't have the same issue.
Right, and then other people think they're unfriendly or
right,
they...
Right.
Yeah, there are all sorts of problems.
It helps you understand social skills issues in mm-hmm. kids mm-hmm. who don't get the cue that, hey, you're bothering me.
Exactly.
They don't get
exactly.
that cue. It's not that they don't have facial recognition necessarily, but maybe part of it is that,
mm-hmm.
Not recognizing emotions as much so that they don't change
exactly.
their behavior as we would expect them to.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
And some people have used the term nonverbal learning disability, nonverbal learning disability. So we know a lot about language impairments and learning disabilities related to language, but the nonverbal learning disabilities are exactly what you're talking about.
Here's an email. It's a little bit more right up your alley, I have a feeling. It says, I have a 44-year-old friend who occasionally binge drinks and with a history of back pain that makes him take some painkillers, mainly Aleve, both over-the-counter and sometimes prescriptions. Several months ago, during a drinking bout, he was beaten up badly and experienced some blurred and double vision and even had some seizures. After recovering somewhat, he also experienced some depression, which may be related to his living situation. It was bad enough that his mother and I had to use the court system to get him seen, basically. So how do you distinguish, is the question, between physical, chemical, or brain traumas like this and being related to perhaps this depression?
Well, that's an excellent question, and while I won't be able to, of course, address this particular individual situation because I don't know him and don't have all the personal information, but in general, this is the kind of question that we're asked all the time as neuropsychologists. How much of this is due to disordered brain function? How much of this is due to their way of dealing with their circumstances and the effects of this event? And what in the world do you do about it when you find that out? What's the best way to approach this individual? And that's what we do with the neuropsychological evaluation. All of these tests that look at brain function, looking at the person's background, and learning about how they're accustomed to dealing with difficult situations and what their strengths are in their support system and all of that, putting all of that together to figure out, okay, what does this person need? Is this person making sense of the world the way that he used to? Is this making it more difficult for him to recover from this injury? Is he not processing information in the same way? Does he have, for example, a memory problem or maybe something like what we were just talking about where he's not making sense of social information, but he doesn't understand what's happened to him? So many people have had brain injuries, but they don't realize that that's what's actually happened to them, that mm-hmm. they had a brain injury and their brain's not working normally, and that's why they're having all of these problems. I think it's a great question for this person to be asking about this person that she cares about, and I think that's the beginning of looking for that information to get those answers, because it really is important in sorting out, now what do you do? What's the best way to approach this to help this person get through the situation most effectively?
Okay, so neuropsychological evaluations can be one of the modalities that may help figure out the answer to his question.
Yes, absolutely. Uh-huh.
So here's another email. I have an 8-year-old son with a diagnosis of dyspraxia, and this is kind of a common issue that certainly I deal with. He has social, emotional, and behavior problems. However, doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists all said that a brain scan is not necessary. Would it make sense to do one?
Well, I don't think I can answer that question with a simple yes or no. I would need to know a lot more about your family history, genetic history, his medical history, developmental history, before I could decide whether I thought it might be useful to see if there actually is some abnormality identifiable on an MRI. What we know with neuropsychological evaluations is that they're very sensitive to brain function, and lots of times we'll see the effects of disordered brain function on the tests, but those don't show up on an MRI. And so you may have an MRI and it still may not show anything. The MRIs are getting more and more specific and more and more fine-tuned, but lots of times they don't provide the information. And then if you have an MRI that shows something, what does that mean? If it sounds like your providers have been looking from all different angles and looking at the possible medical causes, and with all of the history information that they would have decided that there probably isn't a medical cause for this that would be something that you would identify, that could be identified in an MRI, so it may not be useful. Mm. But again, it's not a simple yes or no answer.
Right. Certainly I think sometimes what physicians and everybody's saying is oftentimes these problems, let's say this dyspraxia, clearly has a anatomical basis, but that anatomical basis may be below the resolution that we can now study with an MRI.
Exactly.
So the MRI won't show anything, or if it does show something, what that does see may be unrelated to the dyspraxia, because we often find mm-hmm. unrelated things when mm-hmm. we start looking at things for mm-hmm. no apparent reason. It's someday maybe we will be doing the kinds of scans that enable us to consistently show where areas of the brain are abnormal in dyspraxia or something else. But at this point, it's kind of maybe more research. It just doesn't make sense to help with these kinds of problems, which is tough for parents to hear, and that's the problem, because we often get these questions.
Well, and of course, the reason for asking the question is if you want to know that, well, if you find something, then you could do something about it. But truth is, unless it's something that probably isn't occurring for this, or else the medical providers would have identified a potential for this, it's, you know, there's nothing probably, if you saw some abnormal developmental structure in the brain, it that might be responsible for it, but may not be something you can change anyway.
Can't do anything about
so
it.
So the thing that you're doing, if the therapies and so on, that's the way to change it,
right,
and to make to help with the functioning.
Right. All right, we're in our last 5 minutes. Carrie, you're on line one. I just want to remind you we're in the last 5 minutes. I'm sorry it's taken us a while to get to you. What's your question? Let's see if we can help you.
Thank you for taking my call. I have had a reoccurring nightmare from an event that happened playing hide-and-seek when I was about 4 or 5 years old. So I kind of have this hazy memory, and the reoccurring nightmare happens where I got locked into a furnace room, and I think there's a door where when I'm in the nightmare, then I'm going to that wall for the door. And if I don't have a nightlight, this can happen on a kind of regular basis, maybe once a week. So I'm 51 years old, and I've been having this since I was quite young, and I've never known where to turn to try to figure out how to make this stop or how to deal with it, who to go to.
That's really interesting. I appreciate you sharing your experience. And it might be useful for you to know that this is not an uncommon experience for people. What we are learning is that trauma is so common to so many of us and affects us in ways that might be surprising, and that it can persist throughout our lives. And working with combat veterans who had experiences in Vietnam that were starting to come up many years later that were very vivid, it's just astonishing how I recognized how powerful and persistent those experiences can be, and how uncomfortable and disruptive sometimes, like in your sleep, it could be. While you may not have, I don't know you personally and don't know all about you, but that is a symptom of trauma usually, and you may not have post-traumatic stress disorder in its full-blown fashion and all of the different characteristics of that, but it sounds like you've had a traumatic experience that would benefit from a trauma-based therapy, an intervention that can help you to get through the anxieties and the fears associated with that event and get beyond it, so that you don't have to have that recurrent nightmare. And that can be provided through therapies that are that focus on trauma or PTSD, even though you may not have actual PTSD. But the focus on trauma or PTSD, like the EMDR and other approaches that are really effective with that kind of experience. So thank you very much, Carrie, for sharing that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for the information.
You're all welcome.
Right. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
All right. So some programs just seem to go faster than others. This is amazing to me. We're in our last couple of minutes. And I think what I'd like to do at this point is just leave the listeners with a couple of important things they should take away from the program today. What do we want to make sure they've heard and try to remember from today's program?
Well, in my experience over time now, lots of time, I have come to realize that learning and our environment don't determine everything. And it's not just a matter of always pulling yourself up by your bootstraps or doing the right thing and getting your act together, that sometimes we just can't do that. I'm not saying that we can't improve, but I think the real catch is to figure out where our ability to respond comes from, where our responsibility comes from. Sometimes we are limited in our ability to respond in certain ways, and our brains limit us in those ways. And it's important for us to realize that it may not really be our fault, in the sense that we didn't plan it. We're not trying to do it this way. We are not reacting this way because we want to, but because we don't understand how our brains are affecting our behavior. That doesn't mean that you can't learn ways to deal with it and address it, compensate or recover your strengths, but that it's not just that, it's not just a matter of nurture, but there is that nature component. There is that internal component of how we're made when we're born.
Yeah, one of the things that just dawned on me is that oftentimes, especially when we think about post-traumatic stress, it's the environment that caused this change in our brain, so that psychotherapy, the environment can theoretically change it back to help again. And that's the first time I've ever really kind of thought of it in those terms, but it is the importance of understanding that psychotherapies can help these issues.
Absolutely. And in some cases where there are specific brain injuries or strokes, mm-hmm. it may be that some abilities won't be fully recovered or recovered at all, but you learn other ways to compensate and make up for that. And so there is hope. It's not that it's gone or that you can't do anything. You can make changes.
All right. My thanks to today's guest, Anchorage neuropsychologist Dr. Deborah Gideon. Thanks so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, Dr. Woodard. It's been great to be here.
If you want to continue this conversation, you can join KSK on Facebook. Line one returns next Monday, by the way, August 18th at 2 p.m., and we're going to be discussing running with Jeff Galloway, a former Olympian, and Sharon Fisherman of the Anchorage Running Club. We need to do a little bit more to stay healthy, and this is one way we'll try to help. Remember, you can listen on FM 91.1. Pat Yak is our chief content officer. Monica Gokey is our web editor and engineer of today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.